matter for argument this morning is Vento versus Critchfield et al., or Vento et al. Versus Critchfield et al., I should say. Counsel, would you come forward, please? Mr. Furstein, am I pronouncing that correctly? You're correct.
Well, it's not the Firestein.
Firestein. Right. You may proceed.
Thank you very much for having me. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
2 minutes? All right, granted. 2 minutes. Other than three.
May it please the court. I don't think that there is any real dispute between the appellant and the appellee with respect to the actual decision that was rendered in connection with these proceedings. There really was not a decision because it was an order that was accompanied by really nothing further. There was no finding of fact.
Right. We understand that. I confess for me anyway, there are, however, some ambiguities or there is some lack of clarity with respect to a couple of preliminary matters, what we might call housekeeping matters. And I'd like to try to resolve those first. Alliance Royalties LLC was not included in the district court's September 30, 2015 judgment, and wasn't addressed in the district court's September 30, 2016 order, which was a denial of reconsideration. So it has appeared that there's no judgment been entered as to that party, ARLC. And that the Ventos don't dispute the resolution of their claims against AR LLC. Am I right about that?
Alliance Royalties LLC was an entity that was formed by...
That was not my question. We're going to take a long time resolving a lot of the preliminary matters that don't get answers. I mean, is there any dispute or not? We're not.
It is disputed... And it is the plaintiff's position that Alliance Royalties LLC should have been included as a part of the order of Judge Gomez.
Can you point us to a specific place in the record where you pressed your claims against AR LLC and preserved them for appeal?
I can that way stand here right now.
Well, I didn't find it in your brief either. So. Let me ask you about another part. September 30, 2016 order partially denying reconsideration. Again, there the district court granted judgment against First Fidelity Trust, FFT, and Fidelity Insurance Company, FIC, and Citadel Insurance, CIC. May we presume that you're not challenging this favorable decision?
Obviously, we are.
All right. So... you would agree that the grant of that entry of judgments means that none of the remaining arguments pertain to personal jurisdiction over FFT, FIC, and CIC. They can all be disregarded in as much as the entry of judgment obviously indicates the district court exercised personal jurisdiction over those three entities.
Ordinarily, Your Honor, I would agree with that. However, because this is an action that was sounding the civil racketeering action, both in the actual complaint and in the arbitration complaint that was filed, jurisdiction upon the additional offshore entities that were inextricably woven into FFT, FIC, and Citadel should be taken into consideration, and as a result of that, the offshore
Well, is there an alleged RICO injury within the jurisdiction?
Absolutely.
What is that? That was put.
The racketeering enterprise that was created by Mr. Donaldson, Mr. Crithfield, and Mr. Lake may have originated in their minds when they were residing in Florida, Nevis, Anguilla, and other jurisdictions, but they targeted wealthy individuals like the Bento family in order to separate them from their wealth.
And what were the actions, the RICO actions, that occurred within this forum?
The RICO actions were the taking of those funds under false pretenses, causing those funds to be taken, causing new entities, including the offshore entities that we're talking about here, to be formed so that they could take it from one pocket, put it into another pocket, and then put it offshore. So even after they agreed to pay back the funds in writing, in the settlement agreement that was mediated, and as a result of the arbitration award, that it was beyond the ability of the Bentos to obtain those funds. It was essentially allowing, essentially what they did was they took funds from the Bentos, ran it through the machinery, milked it, took every dime they could, and what was ever left over and subject to being able to be executed upon under the judgments, they then formed new entities in order to frustrate the ability of the Bentos to obtain.
Okay, but within that, what is the domestic injury? The loss of the funds?
It is the loss of the funds. It is the loss of inheritance. It is the loss of private annuity payments that were required to be made to the Bentos in the Virgin Islands. You have to understand that this was a very...
Excuse me a second. I believe Judge Sirica has a question.
Yes.
Are any of these assets located in the Virgin Islands over which is personal jurisdiction?
The assets that were taken from the Bentos were moved from the state of California to the U.S. Virgin Islands, to the Cayman Islands, and then from the Cayman Islands into the island of Anguilla and the island of Nevis. They ended up at the National Bank of Anguilla, where Mr. Keithley Lake, one of the defendants in this case, his brother, was the president of the bank. We also had proof that established that Mr. Victor Banks, who was the Minister of Finance of Anguilla, was paid approximately $1 million by this enterprise, so that the complaints that were brought by the Bentos directly against these individuals and these companies would stop, and that there would be no more victims. But there were victims.
You have referred during your argument, and I think make mention of this in your brief, that there was a lack of a reasoned opinion from the district court, and that has left you in some state of confusion, I suppose. But you didn't move at any point to have the district court clarify its order or to request further reasoning, did you?
Judge, we made motion for reconsideration after.
None of that.
Yeah, and after that, we received the court's order, and it was our impression, based upon what the court's order indicated, that we would be receiving specific findings of fact and conclusions of law. That never happened.
All right, well, yeah.
We were careful to make sure that we didn't know the statute of limitations on the appeal.
All right, let me ask you another argument you've raised. You have invoked the choice of law provision in the settlement. We're taking the position of choice of law agreement and a settlement agreement or an arbitration agreement is the equivalent of conceding your personal jurisdiction.
It's our position that by entering into the arbitration agreement and by the district court's approving that and staying the proceedings in the district court, that constitutes a...
The arbitration agreement has a clause that specifically reserves all defenses. Why wouldn't
there is a specific clause that preserves defenses. The proof in this case has, in our opinion, overwhelmingly established that there was personal jurisdiction. Not only by the law.
Well, there's two different points there.
There are two different points there. That is correct.
The settlement agreement is different because that is not a reservation of rights clause. Arbitration agreement, though, does have the reservation of rights clause.
It does have a reservation of rights clause, and I think specifically says that this agreement to arbitrate shall not be considered as a waiver of the rights that the defendants may have to raise personal jurisdiction in the district court.
So that doesn't give you in personam jurisdiction, in fact, the answer in the arbitration.
It doesn't allow me to just ignore it, obviously. What it allows me to do, however, is to bring before the district court specific proof that there was an agent that the Fidelity Insurance Company had. The agent was on a waterfront. His name was Gary Hatch. That there were photographs of the agent.
Who is Gary Hatch? Wasn't he actually the agent of your client?
He was actually the investment representative that was appointed by Fidelity Insurance Company pursuant to a written contract.
Your client had no agreement that he was to act as their agent?
He did. He was a double agent. And the lawyers who were representing Fidelity Insurance Company, Handler, Thayer, and Duggan, were also acting as lawyers for the Vendo family. And it's interesting, they took off $1 million in legal fees from the Vendo family, and then after the transfer of the funds, $34 million came to the hands of Fidelity, Handler, Thayer, and Duggan got themselves another $1 million payment.
You're relying repeatedly on Hatch's declarations.
Yes.
But the only mention that I could find in the declaration was to Alliance Holding Company, and it mentions that the Fidelity Insurance Company was owned by a company registered in Nevis named Alliance Holding Company Limited. But that doesn't tie you into the Virgin Islands by virtue of the declarations, does it?
In the proof that we submitted to the district court, we were able to, I believe, show that there was an umbrella called Alliance Holding Company.
And I was going to ask that, if you can get this, it's a piercing veil theory?
Yes.
And how do you pierce the veil based upon the record that is here, what was done to try to get beyond the corporate entity?
Well, they were personally involved in taking funds and not investing funds in the way that they were. We're not talking about Alliance Holding Company at the top, we're talking about the subsidiaries, the individuals who worked for them. But Alliance Holding Company then was able to receive funds, so that one of the vendors, for example, paid $34 million. Funds would come in, they would be skimmed off as a result of various.
They'd come into which entity?
And then they would go upstream.
To which entity would they come into?
Go
the individual subs?
They would go into a platform of entities. They would go into the First Fidelity Trust, they would go to Fidelity Insurance Company, they would go to Western or Hope and Turnberry, they would go into Alliance Royalties Inc., they would go into another company called Waterdeer, they would go into another company called Malik.
And they'd end up with Alliance Holding.
And they were all under Alliance Holding.
Is that enough to get you to pierce the corporate veil of Alliance Holding so that the actions of one of the subsidiaries are called a subsidiary?
Well, I think that it may not under some circumstances, but when we're able to show that the Minister of Finance of the country of Anguilla is receiving $1 million payments as a result of his ownership of Alliance Holding, and then he ignores the complaints that are being filed by the very victims that are being leased as a result of this, I think that it raises much more than a little bit of a stink.
Let me return to another housekeeping or preliminary.
Yes, sir. Matter.
I did not see anywhere in your brief an argument about the long arm statute reaching Borders and HH or AP Holdings. Are you conceding here that those entities do not have any minimum contacts with the BI?
Judge, those two entities, New Hope Holdings and
actually, I mentioned three, Fortress, NHH, and AP Holdings.
Those were entities that were being utilized in order to accept funds from the, I'll call it the four companies, the originating companies.
So the answer to my question is?
The answer to your question is there were fraudulent conveyances that were made to those companies, and I believe that would make them subject to the long-arm statute as a result of the tort of fraudulently conveying out assets.
Judge Sirica, do you have questions?
No.
Very well. Thank you very much. We'll have you back on the phone, Mr. Fleischman.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, it's John Bennett. I have law office of John H. Bennett, PC, representing, I appeared in this appeal for Alliance Holding Company, LTD. And I also prepared the consolidated brief on behalf of all of the appellees and been designated to present the oral argument of this matter.
Maybe help me do it. Three appellees?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
three appellees. Yes, Your Honor.
The appellees listed on the brief are Alliance Holding Company, New Hope Holdings, and Westminster Hope and Turnberry. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what happened to everybody else?
Without revealing any confidences, Your Honor, I can say that those other entities are not capable of.
I understand.
If you look in the record of the district court, you will find that there was a motion to withdraw as counsel that was ultimately denied without prejudice by the district court because we said myself and Attorney Ray, who is co-counsel on this matter, had moved to withdraw because those entities are either dissolved or defunct and incapable of doing anything, including directing counsel with it.
Are you suggesting in your brief, as seemed to be suggested or implied perhaps by your professor, that the lack of a reasoned opinion from the district court somehow precludes us from exercising jurisdiction?
It's not the, to try to respond to the court's question, it's not so much the lack of reasoned opinion that draws this court's jurisdiction into question. The fact that the court doesn't say that this is the end.
Is that the same thing as saying that we lack a final order here?
Well, I'm not sure we have a final order. There is one thing if you look at the
document. Well, your lack of certainty really doesn't help us. I mean, either there is or there isn't.
The lack of a reasoned opinion gives us two problems. One is the question of this court's jurisdiction. It's not clear whether or not this is the district court's final word on this matter, because for one thing, there was no direction from the court once this.
Did you ever? Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Parsky. Did you ever move the court to clarify the matter or to request a reasoned decision?
No, we did not. The court, in its footnote to the judgment. Footnote 1 on page 1 of the judgment says I'll be issuing a memorandum opinion later outlining the reasons for my ruling, but there's as yet been no memorandum opinion issued.
It's strange because it was a request of the arbitrators not to make any conclusions of fact or law, which particularly troubles me on the RICO aspect because there was no finding at all, as I recall, the arbitrator didn't reach the RICO thing. There was no finding of a RICO enterprise, there was no finding of a act pursuant to the formation of the legal enterprise. Could be wrong about that, but we see it pop up now. It's kind of true. Let me ask you this. What, if any, significance should we draw from the fact that there is a reservation of rights clause in the arbitration agreement, but not in the settlement agreement? And given your client's consent to have the law of the Virgin Islands governed, why wouldn't that be sufficient to consent to personal jurisdiction under the settlement agreement?
I'll try to work my way back through the ones that the court has stated. The choice of law, the choice of selecting Virgin Islands law to apply to, that was to the, both to the arbitration, the agreement to arbitrate, to the issues that were going to be determined in arbitration, and to the enforcement of the settlement agreement. That was all choice of Virgin Islands law. But that does not, that is simply a choice of law. You can have a choice of law provision in a contract selecting New York law that has no, it doesn't mean that you are submitting to the law, it doesn't mean you're submitting to the personal jurisdiction of the forum whose law you select to substantively control the issues in the case.
Well, let me raise another question relative to how perhaps one of the appellees may have submitted to jurisdiction. Westminster, WHT. They're the only appellee here that joined in the motion to vacate the arbitration award. Is that right?
I don't have a motion in front of me, Your Honor, although I didn't prepare it. The court as being correct.
Irrespective of how many of participating appellees here, didn't that motion effectively request substantive relief from the district?
It requested the court to vacate the arbitration award. The thrust of the argument on that motion was because the Bentos had already assigned away all to the award end of the settlement agreement, to another end.
If that's affirmative relief being sought, isn't that submission to the jurisdiction before? I mean, is that sufficient to ask it another way, to waive objections to personal jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor. And the district court directly addressed that question in its September 30, 2015 opinion, which was the subject of the appellant's subsequent motion for consideration. And we relied on that same case law that the effect that you have moved to vacate an arbitration award, the case law is clear that that does not constitute a submission to the jurisdiction of the court. And I would, as far as the record of this matter, that was extensively discussed by the district court at included in our appendix in this matter, at page, commencing on pages page 42 of the appendix through 43 of the appendix.
Judge Sirica, do you have any questions at this juncture? We're not quite halfway through the presentation that we did.
Are there any assets of these entities in the Virgin Islands at this time?
No.
And were there at the time suit was filed?
None that I'm aware of, but I believe the also the answer would be that there were no assets of these companies ever present in the United States Virgin Islands.
Proceed.
Thank you. To return to perhaps, as the court referred to it, as a housekeeping matter, or the how do we deal with this case on appeal, the second, beyond appellate jurisdiction, if this court finds that it has jurisdiction despite the somewhat unclear nature of the court's judgment of September 30, 2016, the next question is, what standard of review should this court apply? Because there is no fact there, because it is a straight judgment, there's no fact-finding as to any of the entities here, the ones that the court found that it could exercise jurisdiction over, the ones that the court denied confirmation because of a lack of personal jurisdiction. That affects this court's standard of review. If the court has made no findings of fact to support its ruling that one entity is and another entity is not subject to the personal jurisdiction of the court, we are left with whether or not it should be, if it was a finding of fact, then this court would be applying a standard of whether or not it is clearly erroneous. Our position is on this appeal, because the court made no specific findings of fact, no specific conclusions of law, that all the court has left is whether or not the district court abused its discretion in the way that it issued its judgment addressing the appellee's motion for reconsideration. And I don't believe that what we have in the record here would indicate that the district court in any way abused its discretion.
And that's because there's no issue of law to review, and therefore it could not get no more review?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite.
You're saying the abuse of discretion, is that because there is no conclusion of law from the arbitration award, and therefore there's really no issue of law for the district court to review, and wouldn't be the no vote review because it's not to review the no vote? Is that what you're saying?
And not the arbitration award, the parties agreed to a non-reasoned award, but as to the judgment that was entered in the district court, the answer is yes, we are at the abuse of discretion stage because we have no specific conclusions of law, we have no findings of fact the district court to review. So all we are left with is the ruling of the district court, and our position would be that the ruling of the district court is on a motion for reconsideration. That decision is subject only to being reviewed for an abuse of discretion by this court.
I'd like to ask about Gary Hatch. Was he an agent of any of your clients, any of the appellees?
He was hired as the investment manager by the Ventos. The written contracts, I don't have the appendix references at hand, but the written contracts between Hatch and the Ventos, where they hire him as their investment manager, those are part of the record, those are part of the declaration of Gary Hatch that was included in the appendix. He had a written agreement, but not with any of the appellees that we represent. The written agreement was with First Quality Fidelity Insurance and Waterbury LTP had a producer's agreement with.
What was the termination letter that the Ventos referred to and cited support of the contention that there was such a relationship?
You find the... I had to dig through the appendix to find that myself, Your Honor.
It's at JA 1345.
Correct. Appendix page 1345. It's a termination letter on the letterhead of Alliance Holding Company from Nevis to Mr. Hatch in Utah, saying that you were no longer permitted to deal with our financial products. There's not one single reference of that to the Virgin Islands or nothing establishing that there is any nexus.
But did he work? Did he have an office? Is he the same as Mackenzie Finch?
Finch was a parent. How he came up with the name Mackenzie Finch, I'm not sure, Your Honor, because Gary Hatch was not a employee or anything else of Alliance Holding. His contract with the so-called producer agreement specifically states he's an independent contractor.
Just think he did not operate under that name.
He apparently used it on his letterhead and used it as an address, but exactly what Mackenzie Smith was, I am unclear. The record is unclear, and I am unclear.
If Hatch worked for any of the three appellees here, and he has an office in the Virgin Islands, shouldn't that give rise to personal jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor, not without more proof that the claims that were arbitrated had some arose from those transactions. We're into the position of whether or not there's specific jurisdiction versus general jurisdiction, I believe. And I believe in the Supreme Court of the Daimler matter has specifically stated that that agency relationship is not sufficient to establish general jurisdiction over a corporation and a jurisdiction in a particular forum. That doesn't, of course, the Daimler case only dealt with general jurisdiction. It did not clear up any of the confusing aspects of specific jurisdiction. But here, the record lacks any showing that any actions of Hatch taken that may have occurred in the Virgin Islands doesn't indicate that they gave rise to any of the claims that eventually went to arbitration. And I see the yellow sub up light here, Your Honor.
The other minute half.
All right. To sum up, first, we are unclear if there is any further action to be taken by this court rather than an affirmance of what has occurred below. That would simply be, I think, a remand to the district court to enter findings of fact and conclusions of law. However, our position is this court should simply review the judgment that was entered by the district court for abuse of discretion, find there is no abuse of discretion, and affirm the judgment of the district court, which denied confirmation of the award as to the three appellees in this matter. Does the court have any further questions?
Judge Sirica, do you have questions?
Why wouldn't the better course be to remand so we get findings?
Well, would that is a matter for the discretion of this court. However,
he's asking, wouldn't that be the better course?
Which would be the better course? Well, we would be back here again.
You're always welcome.
I understand, Your Honor. Although, to my mind, the court did enter a judgment. The fact that it is worded in such a fashion that defies appellate review except under an abuse of discretion standard does not mean that the best thing to do would be to remand for further proceedings in the district court. That this judgment should stand to be simply reviewed for abuse of discretion and be done with it. Any further questions?
There's nothing further from my colleagues. Thank you very much, Mr. Benham.
Thank you.
Mr. Firestone.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, the court's questions with respect to Mr. Hatch. I think he can be described as not only the investment of the entities that that we have articulated and referenced in Appendix 999 is Regional Director of Foster and Dunhill, agent of Fidelity Insurance Company, but he also acted as an investment advisor for the Bendo family and maintained an officer on the waterfront, an office on the waterfront with Dana Jamal, all during the time that is relevant in these proceedings. I think that if we take a look at the long arm statute, we take a look at the circumstances that a remand with directions to include the offshore companies as transferees of the assets that were formed after transactions took place would be appropriate. Obviously, they fall within the, they're kind of falls within the parameters of the long arm statute. The transacting business caused tortious injury by act and omission inside the territory. They cause tortious injury outside. By act outside, they regularly solicit business of Bentos and others in this jurisdiction. And importantly, they contracted to insure persons, properties, and risks. Under the circumstances, I think that it would be appropriate to remand with instructions that the offshore defendants who received the benefits that were stolen from Virgin Islands residents who have been since 2009 attempting to recover over $34 million in assets would be appropriate and the type of action that they should expect. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. We thank both the council for their arguments, their assistance in this matter, which is not without its complications. We thank you both, and for the benefit of Jason Richter, we're going to take a 5-minute recess.
Thank you.